Hi, this is Michele De Angelis. I'm producer for No Shame Films. I'm here to introduce the ultimate edition of the movie Dark Water with the director Mariano Baino.
Hi, it's Mariano Baino here. Hope this commentary will be entertaining for you. We promise not to sing. We will not subject you to anything too weird, and we really hope you spend the next 1.5 hours with us. This first shot of the cow skull, we found the skulls on the beach where the set designers actually built the whole village. I don't know why the skulls were there. I still like to think that maybe they were doing some weird sacrifices, but probably it's much more mundane, much more mundane reason for it. The whole village was built by our set designers, and the whole view that you see here, including the convent, the castle-like convent on top of the hill, is all fake. And even I was there, and I still don't really, most of the time I don't remember that it was fake. And then behind it, there was absolutely nothing.
Yes, this film features high production values and wonderful set design and decoration. How it comes to go to shoot there and how it started the production of the film, how you decided to go there and found your Russian co-producer?
It was the short I made previously to this film, Carrancula, went to a festival somewhere in Siberia, and the editor of that film was there and met this Russian producer who said, what are you doing next? And if you want to come and do it here, I'm interested in producing it. That's how we started. And this whole church, I mean, this building, the outside was actually somewhere in the Crimea, but this set here was actually built in Kiev, and the church there instead was built in Odessa, and we actually built the church in inside a pool because of what's going to happen next, except that obviously they built it without a roof and it was raining all the time. So if you actually look carefully, most of the walls are actually streaked with water, which in this case is right, but it was just due to the rain falling through the roof. And the guy who actually plays the priest originally was supposed to be a different actor who looked much creepier, but because I had to have the underwater shots, in the end I decided the only solution was to use the stuntman to actually play the priest as well. And he did very good job. Sometimes obviously it was very difficult for him. He kept apologizing for the fact he wasn't an actor, but that's the thing with this window here. Originally the nun that you just saw knocking at the door was supposed to fall through the window, and they wanted the stunt woman to actually throw herself through a real glass plate. This one will be familiar.
Yes, this is an incredible shot because you actually destroyed the whole set here, and so you would have done it just once.
Exactly.
So how many cameras did you use to shoot this?
This one was the only time we actually managed to have 5 cameras. And this shot was done separately in Yalta, the underwater following the people. And the that one there, we actually built the set in the pool. We had the water tanks and the water chutes just behind the door. And the door was built obviously sort of slightly weaker than the rest of the structure. So we did it for real once, and we were so stunned when it happened, because we were convinced up until then, it was towards the end of the shoot, up until then everything kept going wrong. And that was one of the few times when everything worked first time. And we were looking at each other stunned, saying, it worked, but it wasn't an enthusiastic, woohoo, it worked. It was more like, oh my God, how did this work? It was a miracle. This scene here wasn't supposed to be in the original film. The original film, the nun actually climbs outside the church, the original script, and she throws herself through the window. But seeing that, obviously, I didn't want the poor stunt woman to die, and throw herself through a real glass. Also, they actually, that set that we built for the church was actually close to us because someone wasn't paying their bills for the studio. So there was a real possibility we were never going to shoot that scene with the church. So the night before, we were faced with two solutions. Either we shut down the film and we would never have finished it, or invent a completely new scene for the beginning. So we thought, okay, what have we got? We got the beach, we got the scene, we got the stunt woman that was prepared to actually work for us. And we invented the night before just this whole scene with a nun trying to save the amulet from whatever evil forces are trying to get it. And then by the time we could get back inside the studio and film the scene with the church, then we had to obviously readapt the scene with the church to actually make it match with whatever we shot in this. So that's how the original sort of like scene got slightly modified. Once again here, the wonderful actress playing the nun was actually originally just going to be the stunt woman, just doing the stunts. But I always like when you can actually see the face of whoever is going to follow through things and whoever is going to perform the stunts. So, once again, I decided it was much better to get the stunt woman to actually play the whole part as opposed to just having an actress and then the stunt woman playing just the stunts.
How did you manage to move the extras and all the Russian actors, since most of them they weren't even speaking English?
No, in fact, we had just two people, two actors who could speak English before we started. One of them was the first nun you actually see coming towards us now. She was one of the actors that we found that actually could speak English. And the other one we'll see later on in the film. But everyone else, in the end, they just had to learn most of their dialogue phonetically. And through a translator, I would explain to them what the scene was and what they were meant to be saying. And they all did an incredible job. I mean, fortunately, at the Odessa Film Studios, one of the people of the local crew that actually worked really, really well was our casting director. That then halfway through the shoot became my assistant director as well. And she worked really hard, showed me a lot of headshots of local actors and bringing them all in for auditions, and we went through the usual normal process. The corridor we saw before was actually just a part set design and part was real catacombs in Odessa, which it wasn't really catacombs, it was more like the underground tunnels that they used to use during the war to actually save themselves from the bombs. But for example, the last cave we saw that we will see later on in the film as well was all completely built. It was a set, and I still every now I look at it, it looks extremely realistic. This was the strangest bus in the world. I told them I wanted a strange bus in there, and this guy, I wanted to find the guy that actually would play with cockroaches. This guy said yes, he would play with any insect in the world, but in the end, we could only find these spiders. Someone arrived on location with this jar full of these small spiders, and it makes for a very bizarre beginning to the scene.
I believe everything is quite bizarre in this movie, with people on a bus, spiders on hands, nuns on a cliff.
Yes, the whole idea was to throw our lead character, who we just see now, into a world of complete madness straight from the beginning. What you see at the beginning there is in a way what happens 20 years before, but what you're seeing is the end of a cycle. You're seeing the approach of the apocalypse. Now suddenly 20 years later, first, I don't want to call a normal person, but compared to all the other wonderful extras that were playing the freaks in this bus, she's the first nice, glamorous girl that we suddenly see. And she's immediately thrown into a world of complete madness. The whole idea is that she's completely isolated. She's in a world where very soon it will become evident that people don't really speak her own language. She doesn't really know where she's going. She's approaching this island, which we've seen at the beginning, and it's a completely alien world. And that's one thing that always works really well, to isolate your character straight from the beginning. And it introduces the Lovecraftian theme of a town and an area gone completely mad, and also, you know, where everything is almost what you would expect in reality, but nothing is exactly the way you're used to.
So it is Lovecraft the biggest font of inspiration for your work here?
I mean, it's become more evident, you know, later on. It's become more evident after watching the film a few times. But I started reading Lovecraft when I was about 13. For me, books have always been much more of a big influence. Weirdly enough, although, you know, everyone thinks that because my work is very visual, that I would be much more obsessed about films than books. But for me, it's always been reading and imagining in my head how this thing would look visually. And Lovecraft was definitely a very big influence, in part consciously, but most of it sort of like came out subconsciously. Now suddenly we see somewhere, you know, we go even further into the madness of this world with someone else who is from our modern world, but immediately she's been stripped of all the comfort of modern life. We see she hasn't got any electricity. She's dressed in a sack that then we will see is what the nuns do to everyone that comes into the convent. Because as soon as you've got to shed the shell that you always wear in your normal life, you know, we wear our clothes like a sort of protective armor. So suddenly you take your clothes away and you've got to dress in a sack like these poor people are supposed to do. And that's it, you take part of your personality away with it.
Did you get the inspiration for this clothing from real?
Well, obviously the nuns, they're sort of like, you know, I asked the costume designer, who was very, very good for nuns' costumes, but they had to have pointy hoods because that makes them more sinister. Also, it makes, you know, with the flaming crosses and everything, it gives it a really sinister association. Although by the end of it, and that's one thing that we might as well talk about, I think most people, when they watch this film, because the nuns seem too bizarre to them, they really think the nuns are evil, or they're not real nuns, they're doing satanic rituals. What the nuns are doing, yes, they are a weird sect of the church, who actually is isolated on this island, but what they're doing from the point of view of the orthodoxy of the religion, they're actually doing good for the world, because they're actually trying to contain the evil.
That is very interesting, because you're trying to mislead the viewer with this imagery of the nuns, even wearing, bringing crosses with flames that looks like a pagan rite more than a Catholic or Orthodox.
Yes, I mean, partly is also an attempt not to have a clear moral stance, because in the end, I don't really believe, especially when it comes to religion, I don't really believe you can have a clear moral stance. There isn't really, everything is black and white. From their point of view, they are doing absolutely right. Like most people that really believe in a religious ideal, or even an ideology, you know, people that really believe in an ideology, it doesn't necessarily have to be a religious one, they really think that as long as they behave coherently with their ideology or their religion, they're doing absolutely right. So they think they're doing absolutely right, but the methods they use, of course, to us seem wrong, because, you know, they in the end they resort to actually attempt to kill people, and they actually kill people to achieve their ends.
Being pretty familiar with your work and thinking about your upcoming one, and that it deals with religion as well, could we say that you are quite obsessed with religion themes?
It's not exactly an obsession. It's the thing that, in a way, religion was never very comfortable to me. See, that the strange thing is that when you're a child, you're supposed to find comfort in religion. You know, especially if you grow up in a Mediterranean country, you're supposed to find all these images of Christ sacrificing himself for us of great comfort. For me, it was always the scariest thing. I mean, Jesus Christ nailed to the cross is one of the most disturbing images you could ever find in anywhere in the world. So to me, it was always scary. I remember when I was a child, I used to hear these stories about Jesus Christ appearing to people and, you know, performing miracles, or people being in hospital, you know, the usual story that they tell you. You know, someone is in hospital and Jesus Christ appears to them and suddenly they're cured. And all I was praying every night of my life was, please, Jesus Christ, don't appear to me, because I would have died of a heart attack. So in a way, it was much scarier for me than even sort of like a demon or Satan or all that type of thing. And, you know, the whole iconography of the Catholic religion, it's a thing that I find very disturbing.
And it's very disturbing in this scene as well. Has been this built in the theater or part of the catacombs you were introducing us before?
This whole cave. The whole cave where these nuns are was all completely built. It was built next to the church we saw at the beginning of the movie. Once again, it was built outside because we didn't have space in the pavilions of the studios. But it was, this is all fake. And you know, once again, it looks so convincing that even if I remember being there, I mean, all this, you know, the water, because I designed the storyboard where this whole scene had to play that way. And, you know, amazingly enough, they built the whole set so that, you know, the waterfall would connect with the cave where the nuns are. And we were able to shoot, you know, in this case, for example, we were able to shoot almost everything exactly the way I storyboarded it, which was great. We even had the crane inside the cave, which we, you know, we always thought it would never work. But amazingly enough, we managed to do that big tracking shot, which at the end ends with these nuns on the ground. And I think that's one other case where people suddenly see that you know, nuns whipping themselves and nuns sort of like prostrate on the ground, and they think, oh, it must be satanic rituals. But obviously, if you look at Catholic tradition, that's all part, you know, the autoflagellation and sort of like suffering of the flesh, and people sort of like, you know, suffering as much as possible. It's all part of the orthodoxy of Catholic religion. Now we see our lovely Louise arriving, you know, going further and further into madness. You know, she's just gone on the, you know, on a days on a bus full of weird people in a weird country. And now she's attempting to actually get to the island, and we see a great actor. This guy was a great actor, and I think he plays this scene brilliantly. Unfortunately, once again, you know, it's incredible how he managed to do it, because once again, he couldn't speak one single word of English, and he was repeating the dialogue phonetically, but just understanding, you know, yeah. We just explained to him very carefully what the scene was about.
Louise here, she's wearing a wonderful red raincoat. It looks like a Red Riding Hood going into the woods. Is that the idea that you had in mind?
It's something
of subconscious that came out?
It's very interesting that you say that, because then I thinking about it, that's one thing that, you know, the latest thing I did, Never Ever After, and my lead actress is wearing once again a little Red Riding Hood. Although in there she's much more childlike, but you know, it was partly the thing that you know, I like the association with fairy tales, because original fairy tales were very cruel and very scary, and now they're sanitized, so no one realizes that the original Red Riding Hood was really scary and really cruel.
I agree. I was scared to death when I was a child to read that story. Little girl going to the woods and be eaten by a wolf.
Yeah, and you know, the original story, you know, she's eaten by a wolf, then the hunter actually cuts the
exactly.
Stomach open and everything. And now, obviously, the story is so sanitized that you just don't get any of that. But, you know, partly was this thing of, you know, once again trying to also identify her visually. You know, the world where she is all sort of like, you know, rainy and muted colors, and it's all dark, and she's the only sort of like bright note in this darkness, because, you know, once again, she's the only, until she gets to the convent, She's trying to cling on to her life, in a way. She's trying to cling on to the trappings of modern life, which in this case were sort of like exemplified by the clothes as well. This guy...
And this is another perfect example of the perfect casting. This guy is really scary, only looking at him.
Yes, and you know, unfortunately with him, he only confessed to me just before we started shooting the shot. Oh my God, you know, no one has even translated this for me. So he had great problems, and it's incredible he actually managed to do this. But he had a lot more dialogue later on, which in the end I had to cut. You know, we even attempted to shoot. We spent all night attempting to shoot the dialogue with him. And it wasn't his fault at all. But, you know, there was no way he could do it. So, unfortunately, a lot of his scene later on was cut from the final film. But he was great. And this shot is one case where originally my storyboards, you know, had lots of, you know, the cut and the close-up and the details and jump cuts, all sorts of stuff. And then I looked at it through the camera, and obviously my sort of like over-the-top way, I was going to everyone, that's it, we're going to do this in one shot. Everyone was, you know, was going, please, you know, let's do some safety. And, you know, obviously exaggerating, I was going, oh, fuck safety. I'm not going to do that. This works brilliantly, one shot, we're just going to do that shot. And once again, you know, I look at it now and I only made one single mistake. The fact that, you know, in the shot, in the previous shot, when she's giving him the money, I should have asked Luis to actually raise the money in the frame. That's the only thing that doesn't work in that shot. But that one, it wouldn't have helped for us to shoot all night long. It wouldn't have added anything. And, you know, sometimes that's one pet hate of mine, people that try to save their ass all the time.
You mentioned again storyboards for the second time. So actually, when you start to do a pre-production of a movie, you do you storyboard the whole screenplay?
No.
Just some sequences that are more interesting
for
you?
Yes. I mean, now I only storyboard some sequences. The ones where more than anything else, the ones where I need to show the crew and everyone working on it exactly what I have in mind. Because, you know, it can be as clear as you want on your mind, but if you try and explain it to people, sometimes it's not clear. Sometimes the best thing is to actually show them. But, you know, the danger, and that's what we were saying before, is that once you show storyboards to people, they think that's the Bible. So if suddenly then you try and change your mind, it becomes... ironically, then it becomes difficult. You know, it's much easier, before you start shooting. Once you start shooting, everyone gets stuck on these storyboards, and they really, you know, it's very difficult to make them deviate from them. The guy on the boat here, who was eating the fish, he was great. Once again, he was eating raw fish there, as if it was the best delicacy in the world, but it was disgusting to look at in real life, and it smelled horrible. In this scene here, the guy, incredibly, you know, that bridge there was built on the beach where they built the village, and it was really that, you know, as stormy as you see it, apart from the fake rain in front of the window, it was really that stormy to see. And the guy, I don't know if anyone noticed at the beginning of the scene, he actually jumped from the boat in one jump and managed to actually be, you know, to stand still there where the poor Luis was struggling incredibly to actually get on that bridge. And the lovely painter, the blind painter, the funny thing about him was that when we arrived to shoot this scene, the makeup woman didn't turn up. She said she was too tired. She locked the makeup room. So we broke the makeup room, and that makeup actually did myself. And the guy was absolutely incredible, astounded. He said so many years. He was another real veteran. He made lots of things in Russia and lots of theater. And he said, you know, such a long career, never once have been made up by the director. Fortunately, it worked. But, you know, it was a case of necessity and showing people also that she wasn't going to hold the production hostage. I mean, the once again, the convent here, I still look at it and I think it's incredible. It's just a piece of basically construction, just the front. There's nothing behind. This one we did in a real fort in the Crimea in a completely different location. But you really believe that thing is real, which is a great testament to how great our set designing team was. You know, they were great. You know, some of the local crews were absolutely incredible. You know,
Well, they were used to have an industry that was producing hundreds of movies a year, and with pretty big sets and money and. They were doing a lot of period stuff, so I believe that they had. Unfortunately, then when the whole country collapsed.
That's absolutely true, and that really showed in the way they could build. All these things. I mean, all the non-cells here, they were all built. Once again, this one we had to build in Kiev.
Even because we don't know the actual budget of the movie.
No, I mean, and you know,
but it looks very, very expensive. I mean, it looks like a rich film with lot of constructions, costumes.
That's the thing. I mean, you know, we were able to build a lot of our sets, which sometimes it's ironic when people talk about, you know, the Ukrainian locations lending a certain atmosphere to the film, because I know that a good 80% of this was built, so in a way it would have been built exactly the same anywhere in the world. You know, the Crimean beach, as beautiful as it was, where they built the village, as soon as I arrived there, you know, it looks like a lot of beaches in southern Italy. It's the whole atmosphere of the film that fortunately worked really well. And of course, you know, the constructions are brilliantly made, but most of it is artificial. You know, it wasn't really that because the Ukraine is like that, but people, psychologically, people always tend to believe.
Let's speak a little bit about Louise Halter. Oh. How did you meet her and when did you decide to cast her?
Oh, Louise Halter, she was, I really believe she was, you know, it was destiny that we got her. We'd chosen a different lead actress until about 2 weeks before we actually had to fly to the Ukraine. And then just the day after she'd committed to it, I get this phone call from a guy saying, I'm her agent. And you know, she was just out of drama school. She didn't have an agent. Suddenly she gets this film. Someone tells her, you've got to go and get an agent. This agent phones me, starts telling me, oh, do you have any money in escrow? Do you have this and the other? I still haven't read the script. You know, it's 2 weeks before we're supposed to fly to the Ukraine. I said, you know, I haven't got the time also. That's the money. She knows how much she's going to get paid. I told her everything. She's committed already. Oh, no, you know, now I've got to read the script. You know, my client is not going to do anything. I've never heard anything like that. So the next day I phoned her and she said, oh, you know, I've thought about it. Maybe it's not a film for me. So suddenly it's now less than 2 weeks before we fly to the Ukraine, everything is booked, we haven't got a lead actress. I went desperately auditioning other people, and as soon as I saw Louise, I knew she was the girl, and she was brilliant. And in the end, it was something that started like a tragedy, was the best thing for the film.
And another perfect example of casting on location, it's the old nun.
She was wonderful. She was a real veteran. She'd made lots of films, and with this scene in the original script, Mother Superior was supposed to speak herself, but once again we arrive on location, the woman is great, she looks incredible, she's a great actress, but unfortunately she doesn't speak one single word of English. She's 86. I thought, okay, what are we going to do? And suddenly I thought, the only way I can do it, she just whispers something we don't understand, and then she's got an assistant that translates. Once again, tragedy, it turned into the best thing in the movie, because it's much creepier this way. If the woman had spoken herself, it would have been much less disturbing. This way, you don't know what she's saying, but that woman understands her, and she speaks, also looking straight, you know, she never looks at Louise. That's one thing that some people sometimes think it was accidental, because, you know, the eye line is not right. In normal films, the eye line is actually sort of like you looking at whoever you're speaking to. But that was very intentional. To at that point, you know, once you got to make the scene weird, to add to the weirdness of the scene, you try and make it as weird as possible. And the lovely Maria Kapnist, you know, the woman that plays the Mother Superior, When she had to put those contact lenses in, which we actually brought from London, I actually apologized. I said, you know, I'm sorry, you have to put these things, they're uncomfortable. And she answered, oh, you know, don't worry about it. I've been in prison for about 14, I think it was 14 or 17 years under Stalin. She said, you know, for me, these things, it's a picnic in the park. And in fact, they were so comfortable for her that she kept falling asleep. when we used to sort of cut and then prepare the next shot, she couldn't see anything. So suddenly for her, it was like having her eyes closed, and we actually had to have someone behind the chair because suddenly she would fall asleep and fall off the chair.
What is very funny is that a lot of people think that this is makeup.
Oh, yeah.
No. She has been made up.
No, I mean, it was all her face, the most wonderful face, and she was 86, and it was incredible. Her energy was great. You know, she was falling asleep only because once she had the contact lenses in, she would be completely blind. So in a way, she couldn't see anything, she would get bored. But when she was in normal life, for an 86-year-old, she had more energy than almost anyone else on that set. So now we see the scene where suddenly they're trying to take away every single shred of Elizabeth's modern life. So they're trying to sort of like take all their clothes away. She's got to wear the same sack that Sarah, played by another lovely actress, Vanira Simmons, she's wearing, because that's the costume that all the novice nuns have got to wear. Then when they progress to proper nuns, then they start wearing the black dress. And there, in that scene, the only thing that she grabs is the money without anyone seeing, because of course we need it later on for her to bribe people to get what she wants. And that's one thing that, unfortunately, at the time we found was very true, even on location. In reality, you know, you couldn't get anything unless you had some, at the time it was still American dollars. You couldn't really use anything else. So, you know, we made sure that we had that shot there to show, because otherwise, afterwards, they've taken all her clothes away. She's wearing this sack. Where did she get this money from? And, you know, the whole chemistry between the two of them was brilliant from the start. This was... The thing that helped was that scene was towards the end of the shoot. So by then, they'd already sort of spent a couple of months together. And you can already see, although it's one of the first times they've actually met each other in the film, but there is already a sort of bond which helps then at the end of the film.
This is an amazing shot. Everybody that saw the film, I mean, speaking about this walk through the silent corridors.
Yes, and this was all in the Odessa catacombs. Part of it obviously was built, all those fire pits, and you know, this corridor was, most of it was real, but the whole final section, you see, it was all fake. The shape of the rock and obviously the door there. And these candles, it was a nightmare trying to get them, because in the end, you know, we needed thousands. They said, oh, you know, we haven't got thousands of candles. Also, it took about a week to get the candles. Then when they arrived, we had to cut each single candle in three pieces to try and get it off. And also, there was no one to light them. So before the take, Louise would go around herself with a box of matches, lighting stuff just before action, and I would go around, and there was another couple of people, and we would all sort of trying to struggle lighting these candles. And of course, by the time we would start, some of the candles, because they were so short already, because we had to cut them in three pieces, they'd gone off already.
You used the Steadicam to do the job?
The first three, those three shots there in the corridors, the only three shots with the Steadicam. Because, you know, we...
And which kind of film stock did you use?
It was
just candle lit.
Yeah.
Or there is light hidden somewhere.
There is light. There is light there, but also we used the fastest Kodak stock you could get at the time. And we made a decision to actually use the same stock for the whole film. So even the scenes that you see later on outside, you know, in the village during the day, I just didn't want to change film stocks, which is the normal thing that you do. You know, for daylight, you would use a different film stock. But I wanted to use the same film stock for the whole film. And I think it works brilliantly, because it lends it a, a real sort of like warm, painterly quality, even to the day scenes, and it worked really well. I mean, the Flaming Crosses were another big, because of course I said, yeah, I want Flaming Crosses. I said, of course we can do Flaming Crosses. It was two pieces of wood nailed together with rags, you know, imbued in petrol around it. So every time you lit those things, especially in the tunnels, very dangerous, but 30 seconds everything would be black with smoke and people would be choking. So we could shoot about, you know, a few minutes a day, because then we would have to wait hours for the smoke to clear, relight the whole thing, and then once again everyone was dying because of the smoke. It was, those catacombs were, you know, more than 200 steps going down, and there was no air at all. So suddenly you light all these flames with petrol, and it was incredible, but that's the way they...
I think there is something that happened related to the decision to go down in the catacombs to shoot.
Oh, I mean, there was all sorts of things happening. I mean, part of it, for example, this set, weirdly enough, was one of the sets they actually built inside the catacombs. This is a completely built set, but it was built in a tunnel. Because when we arrived, I said, you know, where are the sets? I went there in pre-production. You know, all the sets, we planned everything, where the sets would be built. We arrive at the studio, there's no sets. I said, yeah, don't worry about it, we built the sets. They take us down in these catacombs, and down in the tunnels, they've built this set, they've built the nun cells, and they were, you know, smaller than people's toilets, you know. And I said, you know, how are we going to shoot here? It's impossible. They said, no, but you wanted a set. I said, but I didn't want the real room, real dimensions. We can't put the camera.
Real stage.
Yeah, exactly. Fortunately, this one was one of the bigger ones, and we could use it. And the same with the Mother Superior room. That was built in, you know, in a tunnel, sort of hundreds of meters underground. But everything else we had to rebuild. And of course, what happened was there was no space in Odessa. Because the you know, we discovered, you know, unfortunately our poor producer was giving his money to a local production company, trusting them with the money. They were spending the money for all sorts of other stuff, and they didn't build the sets where they were supposed to. So in the end we were forced to go to Kiev, and we had to shoot almost half the film in about 15 days. Although we were supposed to have about 7 weeks to shoot the whole thing. We arrived, there were no cameras, we're 2 weeks late before we even start. There's no sets, so all the sets for a lot of stuff, including the final scene, which would have been, you know, would have required a lot of attention, they're not built until 15 days before we leave. So unfortunately, we were forced by circumstances to do a lot of stuff in a hurry. When you know, when we arrived there, we were supposed to do it with what was quite a good shooting schedule.
It was you that conceived the whole idea here of the seal and the writings and this kind of strange,
yes,
different language, the and amulet, even the pictures of the strange creature that we saw.
Yes, the amulet and the monster. I mean, it was something that you know, I sketched the amulet, and you know, there was one case where I wasn't used to it, to people really giving you exactly what you want. I sketched the amulet, they built the amulet almost exactly like my sketch. With the monster, I designed the original monster, which actually is you know, the drawing you saw in that book a few minutes ago was based almost exactly on the first sketch I ever did. But then by the time we actually built the real monster, the special effects people modified it a bit, because once you see it in reality, something you draw on paper doesn't exactly work the same way. But the whole idea of the monster with sort of like six breasts and this very Lovecraftian, that's definitely a very Lovecraftian type of monster, although Lovecraft never shows his monsters in his books, which in this case is a great thing, because everyone is free to, in a way, imagine whatever they've got in their head. And of course, everyone can actually modify their monsters according to their own fears and their own obsessions. And, you know, this, once again, this room was a real space in the catacombs, but obviously, you know, the whole set, this wall, the fireplace and everything was built by the set designers. And it all blends in beautifully. At this point, she finds a secret passage because she sees lights, and she finds that actually the whole underneath the convent That's when she suddenly realizes underneath the convent that this labyrinth of catacombs where some weird stuff goes on. And that's suddenly she decides, you know, she realizes they're carrying a corpse. Now, someone has told her that her friend has actually gone back to England. Now suddenly she realizes that maybe her friend is actually there, sort of like being carried by the nuns, and obviously at this precise moment she doesn't understand why. You see that all these catacombs here were real, but you know the whole passage where she's going through there, this whole wall was instead built.
But it's amazing because everything matches perfectly.
Yes, I mean the whole art direction team of this movie, they were absolutely wonderful and very willing. That's the other great thing about them, because some members of the crew were not that willing. You know, you would tell them, okay, you know, let's start at 8:30. They say we never start before 9:15. Okay, you know, why do you ask me what time we want to start? Let's start at 9:15. I would make sure I arrived at 8:30 because I wanted to set an example. Arrive at 8:30. And suddenly no one would turn up until 12 o'clock. And they would all turn up smiling, not understanding why I was upset. Then by the time you would put everything down in the catacombs and everything, it would be 7 o'clock at night. 7 o'clock in the evening, you start shooting finally. At 10 o'clock, production manager would come in. Okay, 10 o'clock, it's too late, we got to stop. Sorry, we only started 3 hours ago. So in the end, for the first 4 weeks, I think on average we managed about between 3 and 5 hours of shooting a day maximum. That was like the most we could actually get out of it. This one, for example, this was built in Kiev. Once again, the plan was to spend a lot more time in this set, because that's an important set. That's where the blind painter, who actually is the only one, weirdly enough, that's the thing I really liked about it, the irony of it, that all the blind people in this film are the only people that can actually see clearly. Because he's the only one who actually paints everything that's happening. You see, there is painted Teresa when she was killed by someone at the beginning. But obviously he can't see. So the nuns actually use him as their eyes. As soon as something happens, he's painting them, they see what's happening and they understand what's happening even in remote locations. This set was all built in Kiev, brilliant. Once again, this was one other case where I had an original sketch, and in the script I called it the Painter's Pit, and they built it almost exactly the way I wanted, which was great. And then the funny thing about this set was that I discovered a couple of days after the shot that someone was actually shooting on another one of our sets, the corridor of the convent. And I said, "What's going on?" They said, "Oh, it's a student production." I could see it was a big film. So basically, once again, I suspect our production manager, not our producer, who was, unfortunately for him, being conned by them as well, but the production manager in Odessa was actually reselling the space to another production. So two of us, I said, you know, I don't want, you know, I was terrified that every film coming out in Ukraine in the next couple of years would have this set.
Yeah.
So what we did, we actually went in there. We actually kicked the whole set. I was so sorry, because it was a work of art. But we kicked it to the ground. We destroyed it by hand, because I was so terrified that someone would use that set. And that was, you know, I really wanted to take some of those panels away. I really wanted to take some of those paintings. But, you know, in the end, I had to decide between destroying the whole thing, or, you know, lots of films coming out with exactly the same set, and I couldn't risk it.
After a few years for this definitive edition, you went back to do some changes on the pictures. And yeah. Actually, this is now called a director's cut.
Yes, although it was always a director's cut in the sense that I sort of like I got it myself. You know, originally with Rick Littler, you know, we were both of us. I remember it was over Christmas, sort of holed up in a little basement in London, cutting it well, you know, still on film by hand, which was, you know, I wouldn't go back to actually cutting things by hand because it was a nightmare, but it definitely, it's a great training ground. But, you know, there are things that after a few years you watch something and you think, oh, you know, probably I should have done something different here. And of course, we couldn't go back to the original material, so I could only cut from the version I already had. But I think it's a much better version now. A couple of things are clearer, and a couple of things, in a way, they were sort of repeated. So in a way, you didn't really need them. This scene here was one other case of, that's exactly, from the first moment I wrote this scene, that's the way I saw it. With starting from the black wall, going into the cave, I knew exactly the moment when it was going to cut. So I never shot the beginning with the close-ups and everything. I shot the tracking shot. And here I remember our director of photography, who will remain unnameable and unmentionable for any of these commentaries. He started going, oh, let's shoot some safety. He made me shoot so many unnecessary things where I knew I wasn't going to use them. And I kept saying, listen, I'm not going to use this. I know exactly how I'm going to use this. Oh, but you never know. Of course, you know, in that case, I knew, and that's the way it was going to be. And it made me lose, you know, waste so much film. And it was very embarrassing for me watching the rushes with the producer and seeing all these shots repeated over and over again that I knew were useless. But of course, you know, that's things you learn with experience, how to control people properly.
Rumor has it that you actually and the camera operator did most of the job on the photography of this film.
In most cases, you know, because fortunately what happened is as soon as we arrived there, we realized that everyone, you know, the core crew that came from England, there was 13 of us, and we all took it very seriously. And so when the local crew sometimes, some of them, you know, as I said, you know, the art direction and some of the crew, the grips were brilliant. They were all very conscientious, but part of the crew were sort of like, you know, they would go to lunch and it would be like 3-4 hours. Suddenly, only one of us defected to the other side, you know, it was defected to the dark side, and it was the director of photography. The local crew would take a 3-hour lunch, he would take a 6-hour lunch, he would sort of like not turn up until the evening. So in the end, part of it we had no choice, and part of it in the end we were actively trying to exclude him from everything, because he was just too irritating. He would order, you know, I would order the drivers to arrive at 8:30 in the morning to take us from the hotel to the location. I would arrive there at 8:30. There would be no drivers until 9:30. They would arrive and they would say, oh, you know, the unmentionable, I'm not going to even say his name because he doesn't deserve any publicity, but the director of photography would, he would actually have, after I sort of like ordered the cars for the next day, he would tell the drivers again, oh, don't worry about it, come at 9:30. So I would be there for an hour, wasting my bloody time with no one turning up. But, you know, fortunately, we had, all in all, we had 3 different camera operators, 2 of them at the same time. But unfortunately, Pete Field was one of the camera operators, and he was great. He was great, brilliant, very technically brilliant. He was very, very great, you know, very good to work with. But halfway through the shoot, he had to go back to England, because he had to get married, so I couldn't actually trap him there. So for the second part of the shoot, we had Mark Milson, who was the director of photography on the short I made before this, Carangula. And on this he came to operate, because once again, for the first part of the shoot, he had another film he was working on, so he couldn't do the whole film. But for the whole shoot, I had with me Steve Brooksmith. He was he was the guy that in so many ways, so many times sort of like saved us from the point of view of the morale, from the point of view that he's a guy that never says it's impossible. He would sort of like have a problem or a difficult moment in the thing, and he would say, oh, you know, grab the camera and sort of like do incredible shots handheld. Almost every time you actually see handheld shots in this film, running around on the rocks and whatever, it would be Steve with a camera in his hand, sort of like running, risking his life. So fortunately, you know, with everyone else from the camera crew and the camera operators, they were all brilliant. They were all very willing. They were all great to work with, so we could more than compensate for the fact that one of the camera crew actually defected and abandoned the production. The whole scene there, unfortunately, the limits of that scene was that once again they gave us a real chain. So, you know, you can see that, you know, it almost works with cutting, but you can see that of course, you know, well, it was impossible to actually do it for real with the chain going in front of her head and actually strangling.
Because it was too heavy.
It was a real metal chain. So, of course, we couldn't do it. And there was the thing with everything. You know, every time it would be, can we do this? Yes, of course. And they would bring us a real knife. Can we do this, a real chain? Can we do this, a real plate glass? So most of the time, you know, because I'm mad, but I'm not that mad. I don't want people to die. I love people. I sort of like, you know, I love most of the people I worked with on this. And I would never have wanted them to die for their art, you know. As much as I'm obsessed by filmmaking, I don't want people to actually risk their life. So of course, you know, a real chain, I don't want Luis to smash her skull, you know, on a real chain. We had to really work around it. And it's still about works, but you know, of course, there's nothing more we could have done with that. Here, you know, once again, I think it really helped that we shot this towards the end of the schedule. Because this is the beginning of when you start seeing that there is a bond that is more than what we see between the two of them. And it really helped that they become very close as people by the time we shot this scene. Because of course we were in the Ukraine, and although Venera Simmons was originally from the region, although the Russians would be absolutely outraged at me saying she was Russian, because...
You Did know. You cast her in London, or you cast her there? Or suggested there?
Weirdly enough, we needed an actress who was from the place, but who could speak English, and we found her in Manchester, of all places. She'd actually moved to Manchester and married an English guy. That's why she had the surname Simmons. So she was perfect, because, you know, she looked beautiful. She was a really good actress, and she could speak English, but obviously she had an accent that matched, in a way, the local population of the island. And it makes it all, you know, it all helps with the final revelation of who exactly she is. And here, this scene with, you know, but a lot of people, when they see this scene, you know, the satisfaction is that they always, I always get them. The fact that she comes out of the cell, they always think it's a real thing, and they only realize what's going on afterwards. But this whole scene is one of the few cases where almost exactly it comes from a nightmare that I had when I was a child, which ties in with the religion. You know, you were asking me about religion and what it means
right.
to me. And I remember, you know, when I was a child, I used to, you know, a young teenager, you know, when I was 13, I used to read. When I started reading Lovecraft, I read this biography, and the whole thing was that he apparently used to have dreadful nightmares every night, and so his visions would end up in his books. And I was always, you know, outwardly, I always seemed a very, very well-adjusted member of society. So in reality, when I was a child, I very rarely had nightmares. And when I started reading Lovecraft, I thought, oh my God, you know, I must be abnormal. I must have nightmares. I want to have nightmares. You know, how am I going to have these wonderful visions? The only nightmare I remember from that period was, you know, tied with religion. I'm in the room when I was a child, and suddenly the window blows open, and Jesus Christ, nailed to a cross, comes in, whirling through the window, but he was alive. I thought it was a statue, but suddenly he's alive, and he's shouting to me something, which I don't remember what it was, with a horrible voice. And this scene with the cross, with the floating cross, with the blind nun tied to it, came from that nightmare. For me, still now remembering it, is one of the most disturbing things I can remember from my childhood. Having that nightmare, and I had it three times. You know, when you have those recurring dreams, that suddenly you dream again exactly the same. And that's one of the few cases in my life when I've had a real nightmare, and I still remember now, and fortunately, it was useful for the film.
There is another nightmare that you cut out from this version, and it's in the deleted scenes of the section of this DVD.
Yes, I mean, because in the end, when I looked at the film again after a few years, I realized that, you know, there was that nightmare that people will see in the deleted scenes was actually cut inside another nightmare. And I think, you know, yes, of course, I love non-linear narrative. I love things where people have got to work at it. And I think, you know, with this film, the main problem is that I'm not saying that it's perfect by no stretch of the imagination. I'm not saying that it really all makes perfect sense. But most of it does make much more sense than people think if you actually pay attention to everything. Because a lot of it is explained visually. A lot of it, you've got to really make the connection between the shots. I think what the lovely Russian filmmakers of the beginning of the century is called the montage, and sort of like, you know, just a position of shots. But people are not really used to that.
Your work has been compared to the like of Bergman, for maybe even because of this silence and visual imagery that reminds us of The Seven Fields, for example.
Yes, I mean, of course, for me it's a great honor. You know, I've got to say, it was never conscious, nor would I ever compare myself to Bergman. So, you know, it's great that people do that. So, and I can understand now, sort of like, you know, in retrospect, why they would. But, you know, when it comes to influence, I really think it's like beauty, you know. It is in the eye of the beholder. Because when this film was shown in Russia, a big professor from the University of Moscow did this big article comparing these to Tarkovsky. Now, I can see why they would do that, but of course, once again, it's not an influence on mine consciously, but also because they grew up with those films, you know, you always tend to sort of like see the influences according to your background, more than what's exactly on screen. Now, we got to talk about the actor playing this scene, because he was great. And, you know, once again, it was just a question where we chose someone else. The guy couldn't speak English. I thought, oh my God, not another one. We can't really do this scene. You know the actress who plays the assistant of the Mother Superior?
Yes.
This actor here is her husband, and he was an English teacher. He wasn't an actor at all, but I think he's one of the best actors in the film. So I said, okay, you can speak English, great. You know, I could actually talk to him. It was great. We could discuss the scene, and I think he did a brilliant job. He played, you know, he was a very nice man in real life, but you know, you would think he's the creepiest man in the world, but he was very nice, and I think in the end he turned out to have a real talent for acting, apart from speaking English, because even here, when most of the scene is visual, like, you know, it's all played with his face, he did the most amazing job. This whole
set. You couldn't tell that he's not a professional.
No.
The whole set was built on a beach.
Yeah, this one was a real, basically it was the real little house they built, and we shot inside. So it was a real location. It was built on purpose. You see, everything there was built. The walkway, all the sort of like the little straw huts that you actually see.
These are usually the fishermen's houses that you can find in Eastern Europe,
yeah,
on the lakes and the seas.
In fact, you know, my original concept was much weirder. The village was all sort of like, you know, in one of my original sketches was actually all built on the rocks, and it was excavated from the rocks. But when they built, when the direction team on location built the village, of course they built it much more the way they would imagine a fisherman's village, and I think they were right. You know, of course, I think my concept would just have been a bit too extreme. I think this sort of like, you know, is weird enough for us, but it grounds it slightly in reality.
Yes, it makes sense, because all the rest of the constructions and sets are very weird, so something that matches more the reality.
Yes, you're absolutely right, and I think, you know, they were absolutely right, and they did a brilliant job. So here, once again, this wonderful actress, someone else who did an amazing job in very difficult circumstances. We could only speak through a translator. She couldn't speak one single word of English, and she was great. You know, the one thing I think it really helps, they still really understand about acting with their body and with their faces, much more than you know, a lot of actors that seem to only act with their voice. So suddenly you lose their voice, you can't understand anything else. They really seem to be great at acting with everything. so that even if you don't really catch the words, you understand what they're saying. I mean, here, once again, you know, the little church there—that's supposed to be
typical Orthodox.
Yes, but it's all built and it's all brilliant stuff. Oh, the girl that plays Elizabeth as a child, she was great. She was such a sweet girl and very disciplined. Ah, the fish.
Fish is amazing. It looks like you had the whole fish market brought to the beach.
Probably that's what they had to do. I mean, I apologize to anyone that couldn't eat fish for a week in Ukraine for my madness. But I originally sort of like asked for. I said, oh, you know, I need 2 tons of fish. They were going, are you completely mad? And of course they were right, you know, I am. But I said, you know, no. So in the end they bought about 300 kilograms of fish, which is still a lot of fish. We threw it on the beach. Poor Louise there.
She's eating for real the...
Yeah, but weirdly enough, that's a fish that actually came from a tin. Locally, people actually eat that fish. In fact, if you see, it's the only one with actually a different color from all the other fish.
Yes, that looks like red ones.
Yes, but it was disgusting. It was full of guts. It had the guts inside, but people actually, you know, it came from a can. And the poor woman, once again, she was a real trooper and she did brilliantly, but it was just disgusting to look at. I can't imagine how disgusting it would have been to eat. Now, this scene here is another case where everyone was begging me to do the reverse shot. And that's one case where I think, you know, the crew is absolutely right technically, but they don't really understand the film totally. Because of course, this is the first time when she's realizing that Sarah is not exactly what she's supposed to be. The first time when she realizes, oh my God, Sarah is playing a double game, she's lying to me. Now to me, to actually show Sarah on the other side of the door doesn't make sense. Because I don't want people to know at that precise moment how she's acting. If she's lying, I don't want people to see her face. Because of course, if you see the face, you can see if someone is saying something and thinking something else. So I always decided I wanted to do this in just one shot on Louise's face, which is one of the things that people never really seem to have the courage to do anymore. A film where there's a shot where suddenly you play the whole scene on an actress' face. And, you know, by that time I had great confidence in Louise to carry the whole thing through. And I think, because, you know, here, I want you to be in the same position she was, of just hearing Sarah's voice from the other side of the door, but not really knowing what she's doing while she's talking to you. So that was... That was one thing that, fortunately, once again, it worked. There, I actually used a flash frame from the negative, because we didn't have the money to do an effect. I needed an end for that nightmare. So I found a flash frame while we were editing. I thought, that's it. Inbuilt effect already for me. So we used it in there. I think it's probably, you know, I don't know, but apart from experimental cinema, I think we're probably the only film ever to use a real flash frame from the negative, as opposed to an effect, just to pretend to be an effect. All stuff built in Kiev again, this old corridor and everything. And here, you know, she gets drawn more and more into the madness of the whole thing. And also she gets drawn more and more towards discovering exactly what her childhood was and exactly where she comes from. And here, now we see this guy with the meat.
Yes. What is exactly doing?
Now
we don't know.
No, I know what my intentions were. Unfortunately, this is one case where I don't really think, you know, you can understand it from.
It's
what
kind
you
of
see.
War. Reading the guards.
No. I mean, I can understand why people would think that, but my intention was that this was one shop in the village which actually does everything. Because of course in a village like that, so he would be the shopkeeper, but he would be the embalmer as well. When you see the first guy there, that he looks like, he's embalming him. But then my idea for this one was, he can't be bothered. He thinks, why should I embalm this guy? There's no one on this bloody island. So he can't be bothered, so he's just cut his pieces and given them to the seagulls. You know, it adds to the madness of the whole thing. But I think, of course, you know, in here, I would have needed more stuff in the shop to make you understand exactly that it was the embalmer. I would have needed a sign there, which, of course, would have been in Cyrillic, so people understood it. But that was my intention. This is one case where I don't think people will ever get it.
I think that it works the same to make you more uncomfortable, yes. Because exactly you don't know what he's doing. You don't know what he's doing with the body, you don't know what he's doing with the meat, you don't know why he's feeding seagulls with human flesh. So.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It does add to the whole thing where, you know, everyone here acts in a way that is almost understandable, except that, you know, they always go beyond what real normal reactions from people would be, and it adds to this whole thing of this poor woman in this world that is completely off kilter. Also, it adds to the thing that I wanted to build in it, and I think it works with some people. It works, fortunately. You know, some people come to me. I remember one journalist coming to me saying, you know, I just don't know what you did. I watched this film 3 days ago, and for 3 days. It seems like I've dreamt it. And, you know, the film works very much on a sort of like dream narrative. You know, in dreams, a lot of times, you see things that to you seem real in the dream, but people always act in a weird way. Like you will see someone...
The real essence of the dream is that one. Yes. That it looks real. I mean, you're in your house, but it's, you know, really
exactly,
your house.
Exactly.
I know what you mean.
Exactly. And I mean, I was trying to build this in the film. This is one shot where it was actually invented on the day, because the people that actually built the whole village, because they were there for weeks and weeks in this abandoned beach building this thing, they started building stuff for their own fun. So they built a rocking horse. Just to do something. I saw the rocking horse and I suddenly thought, I've got to use this rocking horse. And fortunately, it was great we could have the child playing the young Elizabeth, because I think it clarifies a lot of the thing. Without that, you would never really have understood by the end of it so clearly that she was supposed to be that girl. And in a way, she's seeing herself in the same house when she was six, playing on the rocking horse. So that was one case where our lovely art department, once again, they came up with something just for their own fun. And I looked at it and I thought, oh my God, I've got to use it.
You mentioned it was uncomfortable to get to this set on the beach.
Oh, it was, you know, hundreds of steps down from the cliffs. And that was the only way to get there, unless you got there by boat. And when it came to organizing the pause for lunch, they wanted us to actually get to a village nearby. So the lunch would have taken about 3 hours. And this was one case where the whole crew went, and there was just about four of us from England. Fortunately, Louise stayed with us, and we used to do a lot of shots while everyone else was at lunch, because otherwise we would never have finished. And they couldn't understand why we wanted to actually eat on the beach. As soon as we arrived on the location, I said, of course, you know, when it comes to lunch, you bring it here. No, everyone had to go on a bus, get to a village, go into a place to eat, then everyone had to come back, and they didn't want to leave the camera with us. Here we had a stuntman doing this fire burn, and when he was on fire, he kept shouting, and all the Ukrainians were shouting at him something else. And of course, we didn't understand, and I thought, what's going on? I thought, oh my God, you know, after a minute, he was still ablaze. And I thought, wow, this guy is incredible, you know, he's still doing this. And then they told me that what he was shouting, because he was sort of like whirling around, he lost his sense of orientation. The whole plan was that from the house, he would run to the sea and then obviously throw himself in the water and so extinguish the flames. But he didn't know where the sea was anymore, and of course he couldn't see anything. And everyone was trying to shout directions at him, and Neil was dying, but fortunately he was fine. He wasn't even burned. But the other interesting thing, he was the husband of the stunt woman that played the nun at the beginning. So it was a family team of stunt people, and they were very good. I would never set myself on fire just for a film, or for anything actually.
And you burned out actually the whole set.
Yes.
To the ground.
That was the one advantage of having everything built just for the film. When it came to build to burn the house, obviously, in this case, obviously we had to build first all the amulets that she keeps embroidering before burning the house. But when it came to burn the house, we actually burned the whole house for real. And I remember, that the people were supposed to set the house alight. I thought, they were going to do something special. No, they just they threw petrol and stuff everywhere. And then the guy, I remember just before the thing went, he just threw a lit cigarette, just like one of those films, He threw a lit cigarette in the petrol and the whole thing went up. In a few minutes, it burned to the ground, it was very hot. Now, this is another case where I think if you've looked at the painter and his role in this convent from the beginning of the film, you would understand that now suddenly the nuns are burning the house because they want Elizabeth to die. I mean, they're sort of like they're trying to make her die. We understand at the end why, but the painter immediately, as soon as she escaped from the house, the painter is painting the scene. And now the nuns actually know that she's saved, so they've got to chase her. This is one moment where we start sort of suspecting, Sarah, we haven't seen her since she lied to Elizabeth, what's going on? And another case where now we see the nun being against Sarah, and we still think, the nuns are evil. But by the end of it, we understand that the nuns once again were trying to save the whole island and the world in a way from some evil apocalypse that were threatening sort of like to overrun the whole world, and that Sarah's got something to do with it. This is another scene that I don't think many obviously it's not their fault. It's obviously I should have been clearer in the storytelling, but it's one more scene where you see the nun attempting to kill Sarah, but the next time you see the nun dead, but because you haven't seen the nun properly in the face, you don't understand it's the same nun. And the whole idea is that Sarah, because by the end of it we realize who she is, that Sarah's actually turned on the nun and sort of like killed her completely.
Well, I believe that, as you mentioned before, the movie is pretty clear if you pay attention to it. If you take everything for granted, eating or doing,
yes.
Answering the phone or watching with commercial, it would never work.
Yes, you're obviously nailed the whole thing.
Maybe because nowadays we are used to the deviation of the 80s kind of horror movies that are even stupid and more stupid they are getting. You don't have to pay attention.
Yes,
because yeah. I mean, a young audience now is used to have this kind of PlayStation movie.
Yes.
With a huge monster chasing everyone we know.
Exactly, but also I think the other problem is that the invention of sound was a great thing, for cinema. At the same time, like with all these things, the other side of the coin is the fact that it destroyed cinema in a way, because a lot of films tend to be what the lovely and great Alfred Hitchcock used to call radio with pictures, and that's what you get. You get a lot of just people's faces talking all the time.
Yes.
So that in a way, even if you're not looking, you can listen to it, you still understand what's going on. That's the way soap operas, for example, work. If you look at a soap opera, you realize one thing. You can actually turn away from the screen and you can understand the whole thing by what they're saying. But that's not, you know, I'm not saying that every film should have, the film shouldn't have any dialogue, not at all. But I'm just saying that, you know, another thing that Hitchcock always used to say, and he was right, as he almost always was, dialogue should always be used as a last resort. If you can actually tell the film visually, then you should do it. And I'm not saying I was 100% successful in the attempt, but at least, you know, the one thing that I really like about what I was trying to do is that I tried as much as possible to go back to that sort of like purity of cinema, where you're telling the film by, you know, by the way the shots follow each other, you know.
Film critic friend of mine said that this movie is almost a great silent horror film.
Which is very generous of him. I'm glad. I'm always obviously genuinely pleased when people get it and also when people like it. And you know, it's incredible that that most people, especially the first 20 minutes, they don't consciously notice. I mean, to me, it's sort of like it means that up until then, at least they're following, even if there's almost a complete absence of dialogue. This is another case where I think the meaning of this whole sequence is quite clear. If you've been following the whole film, now, you know, the guy has painted Elizabeth running away from the house. So first layer of the meaning is, of course, they understand what's happening in reality. Now, the Mother Superior was once again is blind, so she can actually see what's beyond reality. She's uncovering the painting of Elizabeth, and underneath, the guy has actually used an old canvas where he painted the monster. So to me, it seems very clear that first
beyond
of all,
the surface, there is evil.
Exactly. And that's what helps you understand why, although we like Elizabeth as a character, and although we want her to survive, and that's the ambiguity of the film, we want her not to be killed, but they're right, in a way, to try and kill her.
I like to point out all these things because this movie has been accused to be unclear and a little bit confused from occasional viewers. But again, we are pointing out all these things just to let the people, the viewers, understand that this has been on purpose, and if you pay attention, everything is perfectly clear.
Yes, I mean, you know, as I said,
most,
you know, exactly. As I said, there's a couple of things, and you know, the great thing about life is that you go on and you strive to become better. I mean, I think that if suddenly I'd watched this and thought, oh my God, I made the biggest masterpiece ever made, I will never make anything better, I might as well stop. But of course, you know, there's so many things you can improve on. But I think, you know, some things is just people not really understanding and immediately thinking, you know, it's their right to do, that it must be your fault. This is another case where this knife was real. You know, we do this fight scene, they bring this knife, and I'm saying, you know, you're going to kill her. And this here, the knife,
yes,
was holding the knife. I'm actually on that shot.
And this,
of course,
limitates the range of possibilities,
yes,
to take the shot.
But you know, on there, I was holding the knife because I said, you know, please don't kill my lovely actress. And you know, I thought, oh my God, I'll just do it as sort of like carefully as possible. Here we had padding at the back of the actress' head, you know, the nun. But the padding slipped while Louise was actually bashing her head against the ground, and we didn't notice. And the poor woman, you know, dedication to her art, you know, the woman playing the nun, she didn't say anything. And afterwards, you know, we realized that, you know, fortunately, Louise was doing it properly. She wasn't really bashing her head, otherwise it would have been very dangerous. And Louise was so upset in this, you know, very rightly, because also the poor woman that played the nun, she just had a child that she was breastfeeding, and the production didn't even want to pay for a taxi for her to go back home in time to breastfeed. And in the end, we sort of like thought, okay, you know, fortunately stuff was very cheap there, so we had the money ourselves, and we gave her the money to get the taxi. But we couldn't believe that actually the poor woman has got to breastfeed, she's here, and whatever. They didn't want to give her money to actually get back on a taxi. That shot there that we just saw, that was the Mother Superior. In the original script, there was supposed to be an epic fight between Mother Superior and Elizabeth. Mother Superior attempts to kill, that nun attempts to kill her with a knife. In the original script, it was supposed to be Mother Superior. Because, I thought it would have been great to have a fight between a blind nun and Elizabeth. And then she was supposed to fall into the painter's pit, and then the painter is actually painting with her blood, which once again, I think it adds to the whole thing. Now the final thing is painting of the beast coming out of Elizabeth's, finally sort of like the beast awakening inside Elizabeth. He's painting this blood with the blood of the last thing that was standing between Elizabeth and this awakening of evil, the Mother Superior. Now the Mother Superior was dead, but of course you don't really understand it. You only understand it because if you look carefully, you see that once again, Maria Catalanist 86, she was actually lying on the ground, playing the dead nun. But we could never shoot the fight because the poor woman, there was no way she could have done it.
She was too old.
There was no way she could have done it. So we shot that shot there. I kept it in there thinking, okay, it still makes sense in a way, but obviously it would have been much more logical if you'd seen it was with the blood of the Mother Superior.
We are approaching to a scene in which there are makeup effects. And that's something that I wanted to ask you before when we saw the burned women.
Yes,
on the
beach. Yes.
Who actually did the makeup of the movie on the set?
It was Dave Mundin and Richard Field. They came from England. And it was just the beginning for them. I mean, they'd done some stuff for Image Animation at the time. They were just assistants. They were great. They sort of like they did whatever they could with the means we had. I mean, all in all, because we had to pay for everything to do with the special effects, we had to bring the special effects to all the materials. There were, at the time, there was nothing there. Latex. The monster was built actually in Manchester, near Manchester, and we had to ship it to the Ukraine. We lost it on the way, but I think that's something for another chapter, because it's a very long story. But we lost the monster, it didn't arrive. In the end, it arrives. In this case, once again, David Field, David Mundin and Richard Field did a brilliant job. They unfortunately were abandoned by the guy that was supposed to be their supervisor. We had someone else, once again, he will remain unmentionable. He arrives with us, every day he was showing me how he was going to do the animatronics, how he was going to make this monster move and everything. And by the time we come to, halfway through the shoot, he finds some sort of like weird excuse. I don't know what, I've got to get back, tragedy is happening in my life. I've got to go back to England. So I said, I can't hold you prisoner in Ukraine, go back. They said, don't worry, David and Richard, they know what to do. I've told them everything. The poor people didn't have the courage. David and Richard didn't have the courage to actually tell me what was happening. So they were trying to the end, but of course, by the end of it, the guy was inventing everything. There was no animatronics, there was nothing. Nothing was moving. And they did this makeup, or the mold for this, fortunately, because Veneer came from Manchester, it was done before we went. This is another case where I think, the makeup, I think it was done as well as we could. With whatever we had. But a lot of people, I've read some stuff where they say, it's never explained why she's horribly scarred. She's not horribly scarred. The whole idea is that basically she's much more like her mother than Elizabeth. Elizabeth, that's why the father took Elizabeth away from the island when she was a child, because she wanted to save her from her heritage. And the heritage is very clear here. There's the two children born from the human guy and the monster. But one of them is always much more like her mother. That's why she wants her mother to succeed. That's Sarah. Her whole plan for the whole film has been to draw Elizabeth into the thing until she accepts who she is. And this is another case where I always thought, why? Why does everything have to be literally? Why do you have to have literal reality? Why, if you want to make a film about sort of like discovering that maybe your parents are not exactly who you thought they were, you have to make real sort of people. For me, you can very easily read this as suddenly discovering that that your mother was a drug addict.
It's a metaphor on coming of the age.
Yes, it's sort of like, you know, suddenly she discovers where she comes from and she doesn't like it. But, you know, of course, because I'm more interested in monsters than, sure. than other things, I do it this way, but I don't really think that you've got to just stop. You don't have to stop at the first layer of reality. Yes, this is, on the surface, is about someone discovering she's part monster and she's... 20 years before, when we saw the beginning of the film, which I said that the beginning was the, in a way, the end of the cycle, the first cycle, she stopped it the first time because she doesn't want to accept she's part monster. Where Sarah accepts it fully and she actually embraces it, Elizabeth doesn't want to accept it. Now, once again, after 20 years, one way or the other, they've actually managed to bring Elizabeth back. Sarah has managed to draw her in this thing and bring her to the end, because they've got to put the amulet together, the both of them, otherwise it doesn't work. So the moment she accepts who she is, then the mother can actually come back and the nuns would have lost. Once again, the nuns were trying to do the right thing from their own point of view. They're trying to stop the monster, but from the point of view of the character of the film, they're doing the wrong thing, because obviously we want Elizabeth to survive, although she's part monster. And now, you know, Sarah, once again, she's trying to complete the whole ritual that will bring this...
to awaken the beast.
Yes. And the final acceptance is if Elizabeth will then accept to eat the human flesh. Now, this scene, because we couldn't build this set until the end of the shoot, so we're arriving here, the monster doesn't move, the set... We are, for the whole scene, apart from some inserts that we actually had to shoot like about almost 8 months later, like inserts of the amulet or whatever, but most of the scene was shot in one day. And, you know, of course, it's not the way it should have been. This was supposed to be, at that point, you were supposed to see, like, destruction actually bigger than the beginning of the film. You know, the beginning of the film when the church burst and everything. This, of course, should have been 10 times bigger. But by the time we come to shoot this, it was a miracle we could get all these things. So, of course, the ending, although it's as ambiguous as it should have been, but it's much more understated than it should have been. And some people, you know, find it a problem, and I understand why. You know, there should have been more happening. Most of it is sort of clear from the... Fortunately, we can get enough from the storytelling point of view, but from the point of view of you understanding that this monster awakening is a big thing for the world, of course, it doesn't, you know, it's not that clear, because, you know, it seems like, okay, all this monster is doing is breaking a few bits of bricks, you know, but of course it was supposed to be almost destroying the whole island until, once again, as it's just about to happen, Elizabeth thinks about it again. And you know, she still doesn't want to accept that now she's going to embrace completely who she is and what her heritage is. And the moment, you know, the monster comes out, she once again, she does exactly the same thing she did when she was a child. She stops it. And here, we see, you know, I think that as technically sort of limited as it is because of the means we had, I think it sort of shows very clearly, once again, you know, Sarah sort of like going to her mother and Elizabeth running away. The fish, once again, that we shot it on the same time, obviously at the same time when we shot the other scene.
Of course.
And this fish was all frozen fish that people were supposed, it was supposed to be for human consumption. Of course, we throw it on the beach just for the shot, and all the extras that were playing the dead nuns, every time we would cut the shot, every time I would sort of say cut and prepare the next shot, I would see them with plastic bags trying to grab as much fish as they could. And of course I was trying to stop them until we finished, but I understand that for them it was an incredible waste of food, and they were right from that point of view.
Especially at that time in...
Exactly. I mean, but it was, you know, we must have some photographs somewhere, we haven't found them yet, of these people with, you know, dressed like nuns with plastic bags trying to stuff as much fish as possible in there. And now, you know, I think Elizabeth, the second time round, you know, she's gone too far. towards the release to be completely unblemished. So this final thing for me was always the ambiguity of her. She's become blind because she's been touched by this, you know, too much by the whole madness of the beast and everything. But and she's kept one last piece of the amulet, and for me it was always like, you don't know, you know. Now she can actually keep that amulet, that piece of the amulet. She can make sure it's never put together again, or she can keep that, because one day if she ever thinks again that she finally accepts it, then she's got the control of trying to put the amulet together again.
We are on the end credit of the movie. I wish to thank Mariano Bano, you know, for this audio commentary, and thanks for everybody for listening. I hope you enjoyed it, and if I was you now, I would go to listen the one on the short movies.
Yes, and you know, thank you very much for everyone for listening. I hope you haven't fallen asleep. If you've fallen asleep, wake up now. And you know, as I promised at the beginning, we haven't sung one single note. We've spared you from singing. Goodbye.